One summer Sunday years ago, one of our ushers didn't show up. I don't remember which one, who it was, but there was some consternation in the back of the sanctuary, and the list of regulars had been exhausted. There were no fresh volunteers presenting themselves. And what I recall is the lead usher looked up at me with a smirk on his face and said, "Maybe you could help us take the offering." Well, I'm usually up for a challenge. So after the sermon, the offering was announced. Three ushers stepped forward with four offering plates. I stepped down to join them. And I have to tell you, the next 2.5 minutes were a complete revelation to me. I noticed what I don't often see from up here, that among other things, there are different styles of putting the money in the plate. There is, for instance, the sideways subtle drop to suggest this is no big deal. There is the grand flourish that draws attention. And there is the family bargain gambit, familiar from my childhood, where the parent says, "The quietest kid in the pews can do the honors." Now, one poor soul wasn't paying much attention until suddenly there I was. He looked up, saw me standing over him, and gasped, "Oh, it's you." Then he reached in his wallet and pulled out a little more. But I have to tell you, the most difficult part of the job was resisting commentary. I recall one prominent man in an expensive suit. He put in a buck. I wanted to say, "Is that it? Surely you can do better." But the lead usher caught my eye and shook his head as if to say, "No, no, no, don't say a word." A couple pews down was an older woman who we all knew was going through a difficult time in her life. She hadn't been there for a while, so she had four offering envelopes, all stuffed full with a rubber band around them. I wanted to say, "Oh, no, really, are you sure?" Well, the ushers decided to never ask me again. Some people squirmed at the idea of me stepping out of the safe zone of the chancel. Others said, "That's not his job. We don't pay him enough for that. I'll be glad to volunteer if you ever need me." And the universal response, I believe, was a certain unease at having the pastor observe what the people were giving. So I'm interested in this brief story from the Gospel of Mark, where Jesus is watching people make their donations to the temple. He's watching them. Many rich people put in large sums. Now, was that an affirmation or a critique? Mark doesn't say. He doesn't describe how he knew they were rich. Was it the way they dressed or just the way they carried themselves? He also doesn't say how Jesus knew they were large sums. In that day, of course, money came in coins, not paper. So I'm guessing the coins jingled and clinked when they dropped into the box. See, they didn't have offering envelopes back then. Nobody was tracking the donations for tax write-offs, and there wasn't that cultural conspiracy of silence, which we know so well, where giving is considered private and nobody else's business. And sometimes, when you run into another culture, it can be a shock. When my first congregation was invited to a Greek Orthodox church for an ecumenical service, a lot of them were shocked to walk in, and even before they smelled the incense, they noticed the bulletin board by the door. Someone had posted a typewritten list of everybody in the congregation and how much they gave. My Pennsylvania Dutch folk were shocked. They were stunned to have that information right up there where everybody can see it. And they did this on purpose. It was horrifying. It froze their German blood. Because you know, that kind of information can be disturbing. Whenever a new person is recruited to count the offering or post the donations on the computer, the finance committee will often dispatch me to train them and say, please, 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 count accurately, but forget the name attached to the gift. Why? Because you might look at people differently if you see what they give. In the words of our most venerable offering counter, I have the shortest memory in town. That can be important. But you notice that the loudest and most savage critic is giving only a couple of bucks a week, you begin to see the hypocrisy, and it can soften the effect of the criticism. But I will tell you this, after years of observation, that the largest givers in this congregation are not the wealthiest. They are the most committed. They bring alive the wise words of one of my mentors, bring people closer to Christ and their wallets come with them. And everything else comes with them too, talents, abilities, time, as well as treasures. And speaking of Christ, what about him? There he sat, watching people put their coins in the offering box. Actually, they didn't have a single box. This was the temple. They had containers all around the temple. And they were intended not for outreach or mission work, but for operations, to keep the temple going and flourishing. Because the temple was a big operation. Arguably, in Jerusalem, it was the only operation in town. And it was not only the central shrine, but the central bank. The income was enormous. As one historian reports, there were bequests coming in from all over the world. The worldwide levy of a fixed tax among the Jews, the animal sacrifices and the purchase thereof, the redemption of vows, the wood offerings, as well as the produce of the land owned by the temple. And the income would increase exponentially, he says, during the great pilgrim feasts. Every good Jew was committed to spending a tenth of the produce of their land in Jerusalem. And with all that money coming in, Jesus sits down and watches. They're offering containers all over the temple precincts. Some over here, trusting that God was good to them, were making an additional thank offering. Moses had encouraged that as a way of teaching gratitude and directing it toward God who provides all things. And what the people gave depended, as it still does, on the measure of their engagement, the level of their involvement, the extent of their gratitude, and the expression of their values. And Jesus was watching. The rich put in great sums, says Mark, because they had great sums. But what Jesus notices is that they're giving out of their excess. They're giving the leftovers after building the big house and eating the fine meal and purchasing the nice clothing. Here's the leftover, the remainder. And these people are financially blessed, so they know they can tithe because they happen to have an extra 10% hanging around. And it's not a sacrifice. But just imagine, if you could be generous, even if you didn't have a lot of money, what if God would come into your heart and fill it with light and release you from all fear? And just then he sees her. Almost missed her, but there she is. Jesus says, look at that woman over there. Well, they're Jewish men. They're not supposed to be looking at women. But there she is. No husband. She's quiet, she's not calling attention to herself. She has no interest in getting a record of this or getting her name on a plaque on the wall. She just gives her last two coins, pauses for a brief silent prayer, and moves on. And as far as Jesus is concerned, he now knows everything he needs to know about her. Is it the size of her gift? No, it's not the size of her gift. She's not going to be able to pay for a single candle with her two pennies. Does he notice that she's giving in proportion to what she has? No, not really. This is not a 10% tithe. She's giving 100%. Everything she has to live on. To quote Mark's Greek text, she gives her whole living. It's an enormous gift. Like the day when Jim and I were in the office and he was counting the weekly offering and he calls me over. Look at this, he says. And there in the plate is a cellophane-wrapped lollipop with a note, L-O-V-E, in children's handwriting. Someone made a sacrifice today, he said. And we stood in awe of the gift. Now, throughout the ages, Christian preachers love to praise this generous widow. They praise her total reliance on God, not knowing where tomorrow's income will come. But she trusts that the Psalms are true, that God takes care of the widows. And as somebody else's sermon summarizes a lot of other sermons on this text, Jesus is impressed by her commitment to give her whole life to God. At a critical juncture, the widow offers sacrifice over survival. It should come as no surprise that Jesus highlights her example, for he is forever calling people to give their whole lives to God. It's central to his vision of discipleship. Put your hand in the plow and don't turn back. Leave family, leave friends, take up your cross and follow me. And I think I've preached that guy's sermon in my own words. It's especially appropriate when we know that the story of the widow's sacrifice is placed by Mark as an event in the last week of Jesus' life. It happens around Tuesday of Holy Week, right before Jesus will give his life, his whole life. And he points out her sacrifice before he makes his own. But there's something else here that I see when I hear the story this time. Jesus is watching the givers. Not just the woman, but all the givers. And he notices that the act of giving ourselves reveals what's going on in us. Giving can be good for us if it is generous on our part and if it empowers others, if it makes things happen. It's my good friend Virginia Minor who pointed out the wisdom of Maimonides. You know who that was? Ever hear of him? Maimonides was a 12th century Egyptian Jew, and he taught that there are 8 ascending steps of righteousness, and every single step has to do with generosity. First step is taken by those who give grudgingly, reluctantly, and with regret. The second, those who give less than is fitting, but give graciously. Third, those who give what is fitting, but only after being asked. Fourth, those who give before being asked. And then it gets interesting. Fifth, those who give without knowing to whom they're giving, although the recipient knows the identity of the donors. Sixth, those who give without making their identity known to the recipients, anonymous givers. Seventh, those who give without knowing to whom, and neither do the recipients know from whom they receive. These are anonymous gifts without strings attached. And eighth, the highest, those who help others by giving a gift or loan, thereby helping them to dispense aid to others. Now, God is on the eighth and highest step of righteousness. And so are those who give freely for the benefit of others, who make good, holy things happen. So listen, I bring this up on the week after we dedicated our pledges. I don't do it simply to nudge those who haven't turned in the pledge card yet. And neither do I do this simply because the lectionary has happened to schedule this text for today. I do this because Stewardship is not primarily about fundraising. It's about soul making. It is good for us to give and to be generous. I remind you that in November, as now the mail and the email continues to give us opportunities every day. It is good to think about others and to support the enterprises we value. It is good to endow our commitment to the generations that will follow us. It is good to provide others a hand up and not merely a handout. It is good to give ourselves away in every possible sense. Veterans, those who donate their lives, so that others might flourish and God's gift of life can continue beyond us. For Jesus says as much, "What does it profit someone to gain the whole world and lose your soul?" So this is the gospel's invitation to all of us today, to live generously, to love abundantly, to give ourselves away to the glory of God. And the mystery of Christ's gospel is precisely this, that as we give ourselves away, we gain something that the world can never take from us. And even more than that, we start to look like Jesus Christ. I see a striking resemblance.